Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. at, I guess, just day four of a very, very strange week in American history. We've seen the President of the United States stand next to the dictator of Russia. That's right, the successor to the evil empire, as Ronald Reagan used to call it, and saying that he doesn't believe the 17 or so U.S. intelligence agencies that said that Russia interfered in our election because Vladimir Putin gave him a strong denial. And I guess our president just takes Putin's word for it. Later on, we said there, well, I don't know why it would be Russia, before his staff kind of pinned him down and forced him to say, no, I mean, I don't know why it wouldn't be Russia. But even in his red correction, he said it could be somebody else. Now, that's weird stuff. That's not usual. Even in Donald Trump land, that's not usual to have a president of the United States basically throw America under the bus and defend the dictator of Russia. It's not that common, folks. And it's led a number of us to ask the question, is something going on here? Do the Russians have something on Donald Trump? To help discuss this issue, and really the old Soviet practice, current Russian practice, of something called kompromat, K-O-M-P-R-O-M-A-T. It kind of is like what it sounds in English, compromising information, information used to blackmail someone. This is something that the Russian secret police, that the KGB, have done for, well, decades, if not centuries. And I have a really terrific guest in studio to chat with us about it. His name is Colonel Cedric Layton. He's the founder and president of Cedric Layton Associates, a strategic risk and leadership consultancy serving global companies and service organizations. But what you really need to know is that he served in the U.S. Air Force for 26 years as an intelligence officer, attaining the rank of colonel. And he's been all over the world, and he's a bit of an expert in how the Russians act. And so, Colonel Layton, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark, it's great to be with you.
Let me start, before we even get to the present day, I think it's important for people to understand that the Soviet Union and now Russia spying on people, trying to find compromising information on people, this is not some new, crazy, out-of-the-wall concept. This is kind of standard Soviet and now Russia practice. Is that right?
Absolutely, and it goes back even before the Soviet Union. The Tsars had a secret service called the Okhrana, and the Okhrana was known to be very active against dissidents, Russian dissidents at the time, people like Lenin and Trotsky and people like that. But when you got past the Russian Revolution and the Russian Civil War, you had some really mean types that populated the Soviet secret police at the time. We were talking the OGPU, which then became the NKVD, which then eventually became the KGB. And everybody knows the KGB, at least by its initials. Those guys practiced a lot of different things. And one of the biggest things that they did was, especially in the wake of World War II, they compromised a whole bunch of Eastern European leaders. When World War II ended, the Eastern European countries like Poland, Czechoslovakia at the time, Hungary, you name it, Bulgaria, Romania, all of them had a chance at some degree of freedom, some degree of democracy. The problem was that the communists, and in this case the Soviet communists, controlled the levers of power, and they made sure that they controlled such things as the interior ministry, which in those countries meant the secret police. They controlled the secret police, the uniformed police, and they developed a whole series of techniques, a whole series of tactics that involved getting into not only what their opposition was doing, but they wanted to go in and actually change what the opposition was up to. They wanted to find compromising information on their opposition leaders. There were people like Imre Nagy in Hungary, who was basically compromised as the Hungarian prime minister and ended up being executed in a show trial. That's the kind of stuff
I know
that
for example, at one time, East Germany, back when East Germany was a country, I believe had files on some 10% of its citizens. It had its own secret police styled after the Russian secret police.
Right, Mark, and that was the Stasi, the state security service, and the Stasi was very impressive in their thoroughness. And 10%.
And they would have just people spying. Just you could be in your local, I don't know, bowling club. I don't know what they do in Russia, but it's local sporting
sure.
club, or your local knitting club, or your local book club, and they would have an agent way down at the microgranular level of some small town watching to see neighbors literally spying on neighbors.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, what you could find out even to this day, German citizens, formerly East German citizens, can go to the files that the Stasi has on them and can see. Some people have chosen not to do that because they didn't want to compromise the friendships and relationships that they currently have. But you're right. They went to a very granular level. In essence, what they did was they copied the organization of the Communist Party down to the cellular level, and then they made it even more intrusive than what the Communist Party itself would do. And that was really what created this massive system that allowed for the informing on all of the people.
And this surveillance occurred even before the cameras were readily accessed and hidden, and just basically people spying on people and doing files on them. So we fast forward now to the beginning of Vladimir Putin. Putin is a former KGB agent, more than that, intelligence officer, kind of, I guess, what you did on the other side. I don't know, maybe he got to a higher rank.
Well, he could, yeah, I would say the president of Russia is probably a higher rank.
No, but I mean, but he was an intelligence officer. Maybe tell me this, and obviously there's only some things you can tell me, but give me an idea of what you did for 26 years as an intelligence officer. I know you're not going to share anything top secret, but just the nature of what you did and how that may be the same or different than what Putin was doing in the KGB 20 years ago.
So basically, Putin was headquartered in an East German city known as Dresden. And at the same time that Putin was in Dresden, I was in West Berlin. So we weren't that far apart in terms of geography.
Right, very close.
But our jobs were different. He was, at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, I was a captain in the U.S. Air Force, and our job was on the signals intelligence side of things. So the signals intelligence piece was basically a getting intercept of communications. We focused a lot on the air traffic that was going in and out of Eastern Germany, and there were other things that we did, of course, but that was the primary mission that we had.
So you were kind of both spying on East Germans.
Of
both
course.
You and Putin, ironically, both spying on the same people. He was spying on us, too. But you were spying on these Germans to find out what they were doing. And he was spying on his own people and in East Germany. And then one of the things I found interesting, they talked about that really small period of time when Russia was kind of a democracy. I mean, under Boris Yeltsin, it was maybe a proto-democracy. It was on its way. Right. They did have fair elections for a time. They did have free press for a time. And there was a prosecutor who was talking about corruption in the Russian government. And there's tons of corruption in the Russian government, and the Russian government did not want people to know about the corruption. And Putin very famously found pictures or video, or frankly, the guy denies it was him, so it may have been a guy that looked like him, but video of an elderly man in bed with a mistress. That he managed somehow to broadcast on national TV and bring down this prosecutor. Did you know the story?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that is a classic case of kompromat, of compromising information. What you're dealing with here is somebody, Putin became the head of the FSB, which was a successor organization to the KGB. And as a KGB officer, of course, he practiced the arts of kompromat while he was stationed in East Germany and probably before that time as well. In our case, we didn't do any of that kind of stuff. We were just solely there as information gatherers. But the Russians have the tendency not to just gather information. They also want to influence information. They want to influence people. And kompromat, in the case of that prosecutor that you're talking about, it destroyed the guy's career and his life. And that
it's interesting that there's a word. We don't even have a word in English. We got blackmail, which is kind of different. Kompromat is a word in Russian. Kompromat, I guess we spell it in English.
Right.
Again, we don't even have a word for it. How would you define kompromat?
So kompromat is basically going after somebody and finding as much compromising information as you can about that person. preferably catching them in the act of something bad, such as a sexual encounter, such as, you know, maybe buying drugs illicitly, you know.
Could it be financial money laundering?
It could be anything. Absolutely. It could be anything. And so all of that information, it's not just, you know, the sex lies and videotape piece of it, which is important, but there's also the aspect of financial information. There's also perhaps, you know, if, let's say, somebody fabricated their transcripts from the university, you know, if they say that, hey, wait a second, you didn't, or it could even be maybe they graduated legitimately, but if they raise questions about their credentials.
I was just going to say, in this case, in the prosecutor's case, whose name escapes me at the moment, as I recall, to the day he died, he denied he was in that tape. In other words, even if a guy is pure as the driven snow, he's never done drugs, he's always paid his taxes, he's never cheated on his wife, that doesn't mean you can't do compromise on that person, right? Because you just make something up.
That's right. And, you know, this is the whole piece that's very important in this time when we talk about fake news.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, we're really dealing with fake information that seems real. And the whole idea of compromat is, you know, you find either legitimately bad information on somebody or you make it up. And if you can make that information up, it's just as damaging as the truth, because it seems as if it is the truth. And if you believe the source of that story, then you're going to be more likely to believe the false news that is, or false information that is implanted in that whole storyline. And the best kinds of storylines in this case are the ones that actually take what are real pieces of information, mix them with falsehoods, and then you come out with a blended whole, and that blended whole serves your strategic interests. You have to look at it in the sense that this is not just doing it for the sake, doing compromat for the sake of doing compromat. What we're talking about here is a strategy that is designed to weaken opponents. Russians think at least five moves ahead, just like you do in chess, especially Russian intelligence agents. And what they're going to do is they're going to find a person, they're going to find a target, and anybody could be that target. But what they do is they go in and they figure out, okay, these are the things where that person is vulnerable, and those can either be physical vulnerabilities
it
or psychological.
It could be a man who really likes beautiful women, and if a couple prostitutes knock on his door at, say, the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow at midnight after he's celebrated, say, a Miss Universe pageant, they might think he's the kind of person who would allow beautiful women in his room, because that's a guy who's done that in the past.
Absolutely.
And they might just have some cameras installed in the Ritz-Carlton.
Well, almost every room in the old Soviet Union, as well as in the new Russia, especially at the high level, at the higher-end hotels and in the higher-end rooms, you can bet your bottom dollar that they have cameras and listening devices in them.
It's interesting. Vladimir Putin in Helsinki did not deny that he had compromat on Donald Trump. He just said, me? Do you say? I didn't even know he was there. By the way, we know that he knows he was there. But I didn't even know he was there. Do you think we kept tabs on 500 people? You know, we know that 30 years ago in the Stasi, they kept tabs on more than 10 million people.
Absolutely.
500 is not a very hefty number. We got to take a break, folks. If you want to leave a comment, come to Facebook, facebook.com/MarkLevineTalk, or go to marklevinetalk.com. I'll read your comments on the air, and we'll be right back right after this.
When conservatives attack, Mark Levine is ready, Constitution in hand. And here's our favorite lawyer now.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We've been studying the dark art of blackmail, specifically blackmail that the KGB and its successor, the FSB in Russia, have done for, well, apparently more than 100 years, even predating the Soviet Union. It's called kompromat. It is a specific Russian word for obtaining compromising material about, it could be a political opponent, it could be a foreign opponent, it could be anyone that the government of Russia wants to take down. It doesn't even have to be true, but they find the information and they use it against an opponent. So my guest is Colonel Cedric Layton. He has been he's a former intelligence officer with the U.S. Air Force for some 26 years. And Colonel Layton, we've set the stage for what kompromat is about. I want to go now to, I guess it was 2013, we have businessman Donald Trump, you know, bragging about his wealth, whatever it is. He has some wealth. He's running the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow. He's staying at the single most expensive hotel in Moscow, in the presidential suite. So the most expensive room of the most expensive hotel that looks out over Red Square. Is he being filmed?
Of course, absolutely. And the first thing that the Russians are going to do is they're going to find out who the most prominent people are that are going to big events. They love big events. You know, Russia just hosted the World Cup. You know, it was a huge success before that. Of course, in the sporting world, you had the Winter Olympics. All of those things are very important to Vladimir Putin. And, you know, Vladimir Putin was president of Russia or was in power in Russia at that time. And that key fact also shows that the intelligence agencies were being leaned on to look for interesting people, possible targets, people that they could, you know, either turn or use or get information on.
Now, Putin says, well, but Donald Trump wasn't running for president at that time. I didn't care. I didn't watch him. We're not to take him at his word there.
Well, you know, Vladimir Putin has an encyclopedic memory, and one of the things that he does is he figures out who the most important people are that are, you know, either visiting Russia or that come into, you know, somehow into the Russian orbit, and he pays attention to them.
Now, why would he have a businessman as distinct from a politician? Why would he film that?
Well, one possibility is that, you know, if he ever needs to leverage what that businessman is doing for whatever purpose, he can find ways to do that if he has compromising material on that business.
So he could help maybe a Russian business succeed against an American business.
Or potentially.
It doesn't always have to be political.
No, because there's no, and we have to keep in mind, in Russia, there is no distinction between the private sector and the public sector. At least
when they say the Russian oligarchs, they really mean Putin's guys.
Absolutely. You wouldn't be a Russian oligarch if you weren't one of Putin's guys. And in fact, if you think about it, the people that opposed Putin, the oligarchs, you know, prior to Putin assuming the presidency, who opposed Putin, they're gone. They're either dead or in exile, or, you know, something has happened.
Or something weird has happened, like suddenly they've been poisoned, or suddenly they've been murdered, or
absolutely
suddenly. Now, it's interesting because Putin really didn't have this absolute power 10 years ago. In fact, there was arguably a real Russian election back when President Obama was president, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. And the people actually rose up because they were stuffing the ballot box. They rose up in the streets. And Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama defended the people of Russia's right to choose their own leaders. Vladimir Putin apparently didn't like that very much.
No, he didn't. And that was one of the prime reasons why he was so opposed to Hillary Clinton possibly becoming the president of the United States. He found that to be, in essence, crossing the line, his line of, you know, what is permissible interference in another country's affairs, now, in this case, his own.
To be clear, we didn't pretend to be Russians and put out propaganda the way did for America.
No.
We simply said that people have a right to choose their own leader, and we called out really ballot stuffing is what happened.
Absolutely, and there's video of the ballot stuffing going on. You know, you can find Russians looking in the different areas and finding different ballot boxes and saying, hey, wait a second, there are more votes here than there are people who voted in this particular, you know, in this particular region.
We got to take one more break. Folks, if you want to leave a comment, please leave it on Facebook at marklevinetalk.com. We have a long segment coming up, trying to figure out what's controlling Donald Trump. We'll be right back, right after this.
And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. In the first half hour, we discuss with my guest, Colonel Cedric Layton, who is a former Air Force intelligence officer for more than 26 years, formerly stationed in West Berlin, not too far away from, well, KGB intelligence officer Vladimir Putin. You may have heard of him. We talked about the Soviet and Russian and pre- and post-Soviet practice of kompromat, the way basically Russians blackmail. The Russian government uses compromising information to blackmail people to do what they want. So now we fast forward right to the present day, or at least to this week, where we see a United States president who never had anything bad to say about Vladimir Putin. Even during when he was running for office, nothing bad to say about Vladimir Putin. I can't recall a single Democrat or Republican mainstream candidate. I guess there's some fringe candidates, but a mainstream candidate for President of the United States who would not criticize the, I guess, dictator of our most powerful adversary. And that was weird in it as it went. We know now that they were doing an investigation into him in 2016. Hillary Clinton said he was Putin's puppet. A lot of times people scratched their heads. They didn't believe her, I guess. But now in Helsinki, now after demanding to spend 2.5 hours alone with the guy, just with him and the translator, we still don't know what they talked about. And after his press conference performance and then the verbal gymnastics that he's gone through, I mean, the question arises, what's going on? What do you, with your experience, 26 years in intelligence, what do you really think is going on with Donald Trump?
So, you know, Mark, the hallmarks of everything that you talked about are very troubling to any intelligence professional. You know, you look at the kinds of things that, you know, with the way in which he's praised Putin, the way, and this is before he even ever met him, supposedly, it does bear the hallmarks of somebody who is being influenced, at the very least being influenced by the other person. So the other person in this case, of course, being Putin.
Can you give me an example of, you don't have to give me names, but another example of someone who had been compromised, maybe an American or something like that, and how does a victim of blackmail, a victim of compromise, how do they act? What are the telltale signs?
So in normal people's cases, you know, let's take the case of Aldrich Ames, who was a CIA agent and very famously basically considered perhaps the biggest Russian or Soviet
mole.
It's
like a double agent, basically.
Double agent, yeah. So in a case like that, you know, where you've got a double agent of that type, the Russians found a vulnerability in him, and the way
what was the vulnerability?
The vulnerability was money, and the fact that he wasn't being promoted. So obviously that's not the problem that Donald Trump has. Donald Trump has the idea there's an ego there. Obviously there is the need to basically maintain and hold power, whether it's economic power, business power, or political power.
So it's interesting. Him, like Aldrich Ames, it's this feeling of I'm not being recognized for the I'm a really important person, and I'm not being recognized for it, and that kind of anger of someone who feels that they should get more than that they deserve more maybe than they've gotten.
Right.
Actually, that might be a common way to get someone.
Absolutely, and you know that's what intelligence agencies those are the kinds of people that intelligence agencies target. So what they're looking for is vulnerabilities in that way. You know, if somebody has let's say an ill parent and they've got a really high medical bills and their financial system, their finances are in disarray, that can be a telltale sign.
So what does the victim do? What is the black? If you're a victim of blackmail, and obviously you don't want to be exposed, what are the signs of someone who's not speaking just, hey, I have an opinion, Russia's fine by me, someone who's actually being compromised? What do you look for? Nonverbal cues?
Sometimes you look for nonverbal cues. So in the case of a political leader, you know, somebody who has actually, you can take the case of some German politicians in the Cold War period. Some of them were compromised by the KGB. And the way a lot of those people acted was that they would always say great things about the Soviet Union, you know, say they'd be members of parliament. There were several that were in that category. And what they would end up doing was, you know, you'd always hear of them talking about Germany leaving NATO, or in this case, West Germany leaving NATO. And that, that's the kind of thing. So, you know, fast forward to today, and what is President Trump talking about? He's talking about, in essence, weakening the NATO alliance. You know, the question in the interview with CBS where he said, hey, why should my son go fight for Montenegro? Well, the reason you would go fight for Montenegro is because Montenegro is fighting for us in Afghanistan right now.
Well, not just that, but, you know, whether it's Montenegro or Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia,
absolutely.
You know, once the Russians see that we're not going to defend one nation, well, the whole concept of NATO falls apart because
right.
Will we defend Poland? Will we defend Hungary? Will we defend Germany? I mean, where does it stop?
Absolutely. Where would it stop? And there, that's a kind of an odd, extrapolation of the so far discredited domino theory, but in this case, the domino theory would actually work.
Because it's a treaty.
That's right.
Well, let me ask you this, and I don't want to get too far off topic, but we did have a treaty with Ukraine. It wasn't a NATO treaty. They weren't part of NATO, but we, the Soviet Union, I guess it was, it was Russia then. We, Russia, the UK, and Ukraine signed a deal. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons, and we promised to protect the territorial integrity of Ukraine, which included Crimea and so forth.
Right.
Does Russia feel more emboldened because they were able to basically violate that treaty and take parts of Ukraine?
Absolutely, because what the, you know, we look at the Russian situation, they're taking eastern Ukraine because they say that there are more Russian-speaking and ethnic Russian people in eastern Ukraine than there are Ukrainian people. And to some extent, in some regions, that's actually true. In Crimea, it's also the case that there are more ethnic Russians.
It's also true in the Sudetenland when Hitler took part of the Czechoslovakia.
And that's exactly where I was going with that. It is precisely analogous, and it's very rare to have precise historical analogies, but in this case, it's precisely analogous to what happened in the late 1930s with the Sudetenland. Because when the Western powers, Great Britain and France in particular, agreed to let Hitler take the Sudetenland, that spelled the death knell of Czechoslovakia, even though the majority of the population in the Sudetenland was German-speaking and would have wanted to join the Third Reich. But the problem with all of this is that once you violate the territorial integrity of a country, there is no stopping you. And the person who has violated that initial part, the so-called, you know, perhaps somewhat legitimate part of it, they won't stop. He will want to go. Putin will want to go all the way to Kiev.
So how do you, as an intelligence officer, distinguish between someone who has a view that you and I both think is wrong, you know, let Russia take the Crimea. Okay, I don't support that, you don't support that, but surely there's some American who we disagree with who supports that, but isn't being blackmailed by Vladimir Putin. How can you tell someone who has a legitimate policy, pro-Russia, maybe even belief, and someone who's under the thumb of the KGB? Can you make that distinction?
So it's basically an art form. There's a science to it and there's an art to it. But when you look at, you know, the types of forensics that you would go through as an intelligence agent and try to determine, okay, who's being compromised here and who's just expressing political views, you look at where they sit in the power structure. You also look at, you know, what kinds of relationships they have. If the person who is spouting views and only spouting views, you know, most likely they won't have relationships with people, or at least extensive relationships with people in a place like Russia. But in the case of Donald Trump, there are extensive relationships with Russia, extensive financial
relationships. Mueller has cited 82 people so far. Trump has denied any contact with Russia, and the 82 people include family members, campaign people, people in government. You said with Aldrich Ames, you know, that had to do with money. Is it possible that Donald Trump has to do with money, too? I've heard that only Deutsche Bank would take his loans because American banks kind of learned he doesn't pay his loans back. And right. Deutsche Bank was connected with Russia in some way. Could all of this be totally apart from the salacious tape of prostitutes in Moscow, which may well exist? Frankly, I'm inclined to think it does. But totally apart from that, could there be a money thing, and that's why Donald Trump, for example, won't disclose his tax returns?
Absolutely, and here's why I say that. Donald Trump sold a major property in Florida to a Russian oligarch for well over market price. I think he got like $330 million for it, and it was worth about a third of that, supposedly, according to the real estate experts at that time. And the issue there is that the way Russian oligarchs take care of money and launder their money is through real estate transactions. The primary areas where they engage in those real estate transactions are in the United States, particularly in Florida, and in New York City as well, and in the UK. They also do some work like that in France, a little bit in the Middle East, but it's much more lucrative to do it in Europe and in the United States than it is to do it in Russia.
So this is before Donald Trump ran for office.
Right.
Tell me, what would be the motivation of Putin and the oligarchs under his power to give hundreds of millions of dollars to this businessman? Why would they do it?
So in some cases it's buying influence. In some cases it's actually going in and saying, okay, we think that this person has a degree of influence. So we have to remember that Donald Trump was a reality TV star before he became president. And anybody who has influence is somebody that you want on their side. Take it, you know, going back to the 1930s, another analogy is Charles Lindbergh in Nazi Germany. You see how Lindbergh...
Interesting. Yeah, he wasn't a politician either, but he had tremendous influence over popular culture.
Absolutely. Tremendous influence over popular culture, an American hero. And he loved the fact that, you know, to use that overused phrase, he loved the fact that in Germany the trains ran on time. And that very fact...
He's actually the author of the first America First movement.
That's correct. And, you know, so when you look at that, you know, you see the roots of all of these different things. The parallels are striking. It doesn't mean that it's an exact replay of history, but it's certainly something where history can inform us. And when you see, you know, American isolationism, you look at all the different aspects of the Make America Great Again campaign that the Trump Organization ran, and you look at the data analytics piece of everything, a lot of that could not have been homegrown. And the reason I say it could not have been homegrown is because it was so sophisticated.
What was sophisticated? I know 17 intelligence agencies, they've all come down. They said it's a sure thing. Everyone I've talked to in Congress, the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee said it happened. How do we know that there are Russian fingerprints on what, you know, the Facebook and social media and other meddling in 2016. Donald Trump says it could be a 400-pound guy in his basement.
Well, a 400-pound guy could be a Russian FSB. So, you know, putting the 400-pound guy aside for a second, the way in which you determine that is through forensics. And so there are several aspects of this. You know, a lot of people look at this as the hack of the election or the, you know, a cyber attack. That was a component to this. But this is far greater than just a cyber attack. This is an influence operation designed to take every single element of power that is at the disposal of the Russian state that they can use without revealing too much that they're behind this. Every single instrument of power that they can use to influence things in America was deployed in the service of their effort to influence the 2016 election.
And again, they did this in Ukraine before they took over. They tried in France, didn't succeed so much. They've tried in Germany, Hungary, I think.
Prime Minister Orbán. They have succeeded up to this point because Orbán is basically the Prime Minister of Hungary, is basically in the pocket of Putin.
And they use pre-existing fault lines. So they look at racism as a pre-existing fault line in America, this right-left debate. It's interesting because we have this old notion of communism as the far left. Really, Putin is kind of the hero of the far right, right? I mean, neo-Nazis love Vladimir Putin.
Absolutely.
Even if Hitler did not love the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the irony of everything, because a lot of the things that Putin has borrowed for his political
anti-immigrant
movement,
for example.
Absolutely.
Rhetoric.
The anti-immigrant idea, the old anti-immigrant rhetoric, which is playing a big role in Hungary's, you know, way of doing things right now and their political climate, that is a huge factor because, in Russia that plays extremely well because Russia has demographic challenges. And a lot of people in Russia do not want influences from outside. It's a very insular culture in many respects. Here in the United States, there of course are elements like that as well, and they don't want their economic position to be challenged by people from other places, whether it's Mexico or India or China. It almost doesn't matter whether they're physically here or whether they're just making stuff that we then import. Those people present a threat to a natural constituency for Donald Trump. And so you put all of this together, and when Donald Trump decided to run for president, there are two possibilities here in my mind, at least two possibilities. One is that the Russians said, hey, why don't you try this? And remember, Trump had mused about running for president as far back as the 1980s. The Russians knew this. They do a lot of research.
He talked about it in 2012.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, it was more serious, obviously, from the 1980s.
Yeah.
It was kind of a flippant remark.
Right.
But in 2012, it was pretty clear. So by the time they got everything together and they figured, okay, the reality TV star, you know, high social profile, seems to have a penchant for folks from Eastern Europe, especially to marry them. There are all kinds of little things that potentially show that he could be sympathetic to them. And they take that sympathy then and the money part. You mentioned Deutsche Bank. You're right. Deutsche Bank is a prime vehicle for money laundering to take place and used by Russian oligarchs and others.
And the information that we've learned is basically that it really stepped up. You know, they maybe didn't think he was going to win the nomination, but that once he won the nomination, that's when the attacks really stepped up. And that even on the day when Donald Trump said, Russia, if you're listening, yes, I want you to commit espionage against the United States to help me win the election, which is, he said it on TV. I mean, this isn't,
absolutely,
you know,
live.
Collusion doesn't have to be secret, folks. It can be open and out loud. That's the day they stepped up.
That's
and
right.
Did exactly what
well,
he asked them to
and
do.
They had done it before, but it wasn't as noticeable. But the fact that they did it right after he made that statement is really a telltale sign that there is something there. And, you know, the Mueller investigation is going to have to find out exactly what that something is.
We have to take one more break. When we come back, Colonel Layton, for the last segment, I'm going to ask you the ultimate question. Do you think Donald Trump is under compromat? Why do you think so? And if so, what should we as Americans do about it? We'll be right back, right after this.
Pick up your number two pencils. It's time for Class with Mark Levine.
What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. He doesn't respect our president. And if it is Russia, which is probably not, nobody knows who it is, but if it is Russia, it's really bad for a different reason, because it shows how little respect they have for our country when they would hack into a major party and get everything. But it would be interesting to see. I will tell you this. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
That was almost 2 years ago today, July 27th, 2016. We're coming up on the second anniversary. I hope the media remembers and reminds us. Collusion doesn't have to be in secret behind closed doors. It can be right there in the open. Hey, Russia, if you're listening, please commit espionage against the United States to help me against my political opponent, and you'll be rewarded. Quid pro quo, treason? I mean, you could argue back then it was. Let me ask you the ultimate question I asked before the break. Number one, do you believe that the Russians are compromising Donald Trump? Do they have secret information on him, financial or otherwise? Do you honestly believe, based on your experience, that's going on?
I think it's a distinct possibility. And so it's very important for the sanctity of the Republic of the United States of America that we get to the bottom of what is actually happening here. And it seems to me, based on the statement back in 2016, based on what we just heard in this last week or so, there is a real problem here. And the reason I think that is that there are just too many unexplained ends, both of a financial matter and also, frankly, of a political matter.
And a personal matter, with regard to the hotel.
Absolutely. And, of course, with that as well. And, from all of those aspects, it's very clear to me that an investigation, must be extremely thorough. Obviously, Mueller is the primary investigator in this case. And that very fact, that this investigation must continue is, I think, the real piece here. But for the president itself, my suspicion would be that he himself has been compromised.
Colonel, if you were in intelligence for 26 years, if in your 25th year, someone came to you with a dossier of a high-level intelligence official, maybe your colleague, maybe your boss, who had this series of circumstances. In the hotel room, you heard allegations of a tape, he won't disclose money. What would you do? What would the intelligence do with such a person if they were in the intelligence field? Not President of the United States, just the intelligence field.
Any person in that situation, Mark, would basically be removed from their position. They would be placed under investigation. Now, sometimes if the investigation is so sensitive and is still ongoing, you don't remove them right away.
You want to catch them in the act.
That's like they did with Robert Hansen, mm-hmm. like they did with Aldrich Ames, Hansen being of the FBI, Ames, of course, of the CIA.
You'd get a warrant to spy on them?
Yes, you have to get a warrant to spy on
Can
them.
Can you get a warrant to spy on the president?
That's an interesting legal question. And
I wouldn't know about it. It would have to be a secret warrant.
It would have to be done very
Probable
carefully.
Probable cause is all you need the Constitution.
Yeah, under the Constitution, that's all you need. So technically, people would argue that there would be, that the president has special immunities. But I think in this particular case, I have a solution. One idea that I have is that any presidential candidate, regardless of party, regardless of any other situation that they're in, even independent candidates, in order to be a candidate for president, they must be clearable for sensitive compartmented information.
We're running out of time. We got like 10 seconds left. Bottom line, should President Donald Trump be impeached and convicted and removed from office?
Yes.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Cedric Layton, thank you for coming here on The Inside Scoop. I'd love to have you back. We're going to have to continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us.